Kemba Walker talks about his knee in isolation, and we talk about the most important draft of Boston Celtics history, the 1956 NBA draft. It's right now here on the Thursday Locked On Celtics. Millie's, let's go. Rainy J's back with the vengeance. Back. All the real Celtics fans in attendance. This is the truth like 34. Yeah. It's like walking in the garden when you hear the roars. The crowd goes crazy. Most in-depth coverage on the daily. Mainly podcast royalty, the content kings. When you talking about the franchise with 17 rings. Focus like Danny at the deadline. Global, but it got a local feel like the red line, the blue line, the green line. Play it in between time. I'ma throw my C's jersey on in the meantime and press play. When the F's done, I can't wait until the next day. Trying to stay in tune with the C's, that's the best way. Melly. John Corrales of Mass Live here, thanking you for making this podcast part of your daily routine. I hope you are listening here Monday through Friday, still going on that grind Monday through Friday for you. So if you're listening Monday through Friday, thank you very much. If you are not, then what you've missed so far is the beginnings of our deep dive into all of Boston Celtics history. You're wondering what we're going to do to carry us through this hiatus, but we're going back to the beginning. And on Tuesday, we talked about Walter Brown hiring Red Auerbach, how Red was almost the Duke head coach instead of the Boston head coach. On Wednesday, it was Bob Cousy and the relationship between him and Red Auerbach. Today, it's going to be the 1956 NBA draft and another important relationship built by Red Auerbach with Bill Russell. Going to talk about that in a second. First, Kemba Walker was on the NBC Sports Boston Twitter kind of thing here as they do their classic games. And the Celtics are kind of rerunning the earlier Milwaukee Bucks win from earlier this season. So Kemba was on there with Scal and was asked by Scal about his knee. He said his knee feels fine, except it's a little hard to kind of do the rehab and everything. So I wrote about it on masslive.com. Not a ton. It's not a huge update, but he did kind of say the knee feels good. The rehab is a little tough in going through stuff by himself. He's got to go through virtual workouts with trainers. There's nobody there to kind of give him the treatment, work through things. And it's hard when you're dealing with an issue, especially a knee issue. You've got people who need to work on the joint, work on the surrounding muscles. It's hard to do that stuff by yourself. So hopefully he gets better soon and continues his rehab. It's really going to be important for him to watch that, because not only is he going through this time off, which should be good for resting the knee, but the strengthening has been the most important part. And if you ramp it up too fast, that knee issue could come right on back for him. So it's very, very important that he and the Celtics try to manage that as good as they can while they're going through this hiatus. And it's going to be very difficult. Ideally, the NBA will find the right situation to at least open up the practice facilities. And even if it's not with players on the floor, maybe there is a possibility of one-on-one physical therapy type of stuff with guys like Kemba Walker. But obviously under safe circumstances, that's the most important thing. I think the standing caveat throughout all of this is public safety first, health and safety first, and we're just talking about basketball here. So it's a little bit difficult as we try to figure out good solutions for these basketball players while obviously the world is melting down around us. So please understand that I'm not trying to put these guys first ahead of public safety. But Kemba Walker still trying to get himself back. Read my story on masslive.com. Going to talk a little bit about the 1956 draft. We continue. Me, Mike Dinan of RedsArmy.com, continue our conversation about the next stage in Celtics history. These are pivotal, critical times in Boston Celtics history. Hiring Red Auerbach, critical. The Bob Cousy crazy story, if you haven't heard it, passing on him basically twice, and then that moment between him and Red Auerbach, which was huge. That's a pivotal moment in Celtics history. This 1956 draft, these three guys that they get, pivotal moment in Celtics history because this sets the table for a decade of dominance, and it starts with Bill Russell. That's going to be the conversation Mike and I are going to have. Right now, we're having this because sports have basically come to a screeching halt. All right, basketball's bench, pitchers are off the mound, and our friends at MyBookie are still not going to let you down. If you want to bet on something, they've got you covered. Stay sane and stay entertained with access to your favorite games like blackjack, roulette, slots, war, and more. It doesn't matter whether you're out on the front lines or quarantined at home, the fun does not have to come to an end with MyBookie. Video poker, not your thing, but you still need a fix? They've got you covered with a host of live casino dealers online. That's right. They've got professional dealers at their table, live on site, 24/7. Your favorite squad sidelined because of the pandemic? Do not sweat it. MyBookie has partnered with some of the leading esports brands to bring you wagers on virtual action straight from the court in NBA 2K20 and others. Plus, you can always do your part to make your bankroll great again. You can bet on the shifting odds in politics. You can make political bets. Yes, absolutely. You trust the industry leaders in times like this. They're reliable, they're upright, and best of all, they pay fast when you win. Visit mybookie.ag and use the promo code LOCKEDONNBA for a 150% bonus on your first casino deposit. That's promo code LOCKEDONNBA to receive a 150% cash bonus on your first deposit, and you can claim those extra funds all the way up to $750. Use the promo code LOCKEDONNBA to activate the offer. That's promo code LOCKEDONNBA. You spin, you win, you get paid.
You are Locked On Celtics, your daily Boston Celtics podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
The Boston Celtics were born in 1946. A decade later, we have Red Auerbach in place. We have Bob Cousy in place. We do not have a championship in Boston yet. They've gone through four losing seasons. Red comes along. They start winning basketball games, but they cannot get over the hump. 1956 is the draft that changes all of it. Here now, the continuation of our historical deep dive. It's me and Mike Dinan of RedsArmy.com. Okay, 1956 draft comes along. We talked about the territorial pick. Tommy Heinsohn playing at Holy Cross, just like Cousy did. And he's popular. He's great. And the Celtics claim him. So the first thing that he does here is use this territorial pick to claim Tommy Heinsohn. Let's set the stage, Mike. What's Tommy Heinsohn like as he's coming into the Boston Celtics?
Well, Tommy's a big time scorer and rebounder as a forward with Holy Cross, and they had some team success too. They didn't win the NCAA, but they came close. And Tommy was an All-American. And imagine the Celtics without Tommy Heinsohn. He's been there forever. It was 1956, and today it's 2020 now. That's a couple of three or four generations of people, it seems like, that Tommy has been associated with the Celtics almost continuously as a player, coach, obviously, and broadcaster. He used to actually broadcast the games as the play-by-play man. I can recall when I was in college in Boston, I went to BU, and Tommy did some of the announcing on the local telecasts, and Red was his color man. Imagine those two together.
Oh my God, that's Tommy. Tommy is the Boston Celtics. Tommy is the guy. Like he's like you said, he's been there basically from the beginning, aside from the first 10 years, like you said, four of which included the BAA, and then the first few years of the franchise, which good regular season success, no playoff success. Every single championship the Boston Celtics have won, Tommy's been around, whether it's a player, whether it's a coach, whether it's a broadcaster, he's been around the team for every single one of their 17 championships. So shout out to Tommy Heinsohn first. We're going to talk about Tommy a lot in this series. Tommy's like all over the place, fingerprints on everything. So Tommy Heinsohn becomes the territorial pick. And now things get weird because Bill Russell is there, but the Boston Celtics have the third pick and they want Bill. So they go through this dance with the Ice Capades. Why don't you kind of walk us through how the Ice Capades lead to Bill Russell getting drafted by the Boston Celtics?
Okay, well, the Rochester Royals had the pick before the Celtics, and Walter Brown, as I mentioned, being the garden owner, Boston Garden, he had some influence over where the Ice Capades would appear. And the...
He created the Ice Capades.
Oh, he did? Oh, geez, see, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, he was one of the creators of the Ice Capades. That's why he had the influence.
Okay, sounds good. Anyway, the Rochester owner was Les Harrison, and he had an arena, and he wanted to have the Ice Capades go there. And so Walter Brown kind of used that as a bargaining chip to get him to consider making a trade for that draft position.
So they used the Ice Capades as this, okay, we'll give you the Ice Capades if you kind of don't draft Bill Russell. It basically, we're sending you this thing, because back then it was, like you said, the priority was filling these arenas. So he goes to the owner and says, hey, look, don't draft Bill. We're going to get you the Ice Capades. We're going to fill your arena because it's super popular. And they're like, yeah, that's money. They have no idea about Bill. They have no idea about what he's gonna mean to a team. Back then, that type of stuff, there's no collective bargaining agreement. There's no rules that prevent this kind of thing. This is like the wild, wild west of basketball. And so he and, you know, like I said, Walter Brown, he was like part of this like cabal that created the Ice Capades. And so he's like, yeah, this is going to make you some money. What's going to make you more money, Bill Russell or the Ice Capades?
And so, some of the things that Rochester was thinking at the time, first of all, Russell was going to play on the Olympics. And that year it was in Melbourne, Australia. Mm-hmm. So they didn't take place until December, with the seasons being the opposite in the Southern Hemisphere.
Yep.
Summer was in December. So Russell missed the first part of his rookie year as a result of that. Mm-hmm. Also, the Globetrotters were in the mix trying to sign Russell.
That's right.
I don't know that he ever considered that seriously, but that was a factor anyway in the thinking of Les Harrison. And then I guess they weren't as certain that Russell was going to be a hit. You know, it's going to be a great player. They weren't as certain as Red Auerbach was. And so with the Ice Capades as the sweetener, they were more more willing to talk, to make that exchange, or to make that promise not to draft Russell.
So, yeah, and it's a great point about the Globetrotters, because the Globetrotters were a threat to sign these great Black players. This is before, like, the Globetrotters were an actual, like, legitimate basketball team. They were a barnstorming team, and they had some of the best players at the time. The Globetrotters had beaten the Minneapolis Lakers in a couple of exhibitions. Russell really was considering it. And if it wasn't for some conflicts over money and the contract negotiations, he might have actually done it. But anyway, so all of those things come into play. The Rochester Royals, they didn't own their arena, so they needed something to come in and kind of give them a little bit of a boost financially. Ultimately, it really did not work out well for the Royals. For those of you who don't know, the Rochester Royals go to Cincinnati, then go to Sacramento. They go to Cincinnati, they go to Kansas City, where they go from the Kansas City Royals to the Kansas City Kings, and then they go to Sacramento, where they're the Sacramento Kings. So this history, go ahead. What's that?
And they haven't won a championship in like 60 years.
Yeah. This is the front office moves that are questionable, suspect in the Sacramento Kings really go all the way back to 1956 when the then Royals said, yes, Ice Capades instead of Bill Russell. Sounds good. And that creates this long litany of problems for the Kings franchise.
Let me mention one other thing, John, about the Globetrotters.
Yes.
If I could jump in. They were extremely popular back then. As you said, they were more of a legit team. They weren't just an entertainment. But they were very popular and with the public. And Will Chamberlain played for them for a year.
Yes.
After he left Kansas and he couldn't go into the NBA draft yet, he played with the Globetrotters for a year. So yes. It was something to be considered. It was not just something that the Royals owner could dismiss and say it'll never happen.
Right. Like nowadays, it sounds ridiculous to say, oh, he's going to go with the Globetrotters. Like, what are you, nuts? But back then, it was a very serious threat. Because at that point, you got to remember, 1956, professional basketball still trying to find its footing, still not fully integrated, even though the Celtics had signed, had drafted Cooper. Black players were not really filling NBA rosters. And the Globetrotters, because they were basically exclusively black basketball players, had a crop of talent that wasn't going to the NBA that was still extraordinarily good. And so that's why they were a legitimate threat. And that's why they were so good, because they had a talent pool that the league wasn't fully considering. And that plays a role in how all of this early NBA kind of plays out, and some of the caveats and some of the performances in the NBA, because a lot of the best talent in the world wasn't playing in the NBA. Another obstacle here, by the way, before we get to the actual drafting of Bill Russell, Ed McCauley is a St. Louis native. At that point, he actually wanted to be traded, and McCauley is a star player. And he asks to be traded to St. Louis. So on top of everything, and I believe it's because he had a sick family member.
That's right.
Was it his son who was sick?
Yes.
So yes. In an effort to be closer to his son, he says, hey, can you trade me to St. Louis? And so the Celtics give up McCauley and Cliff Hagan for the second pick. And they move into position to draft Bill Russell. So you have not just the Ice Capades, not just the Rochester Royals saying, okay, we're going to take the Ice Capades. You have, again, it's kind of like circumstances forcing things Boston's way, that McCauley decides he wants to be closer to his sick son and say, all right, well, here's what we're going to do. And that also helps push Bill Russell now into the mix.
I don't want to interrupt, but I do want to point out that McCauley and Hagan both made the Hall of Fame.
Yes.
So it's not like the Celtics didn't give up anything. They gave up something important. You know, they gave up some pretty good assets there. But Red knew why. He knew what to do.
And by the way, fast forward just a little bit, but the Celtics and the Hawks met in two straight NBA finals and split them. So the Hawks made their move for McCauley and Hagen, and it wasn't like the Royals' move. This actually kind of worked out for them in the short term, where you say, all right, the Celtics and Hawks meet in the championship in 1957, and then in 1958 they meet again and the Hawks win. So they're looking at it at that time like, hey man, that this was a good trade for kind of both sides, because it propelled both of them to that title. We obviously know what happens after that. So, but let's, before we move forward there, the Celtics get their guy in Bill Russell. Follow us on our social channels at LO Celtics on Twitter and at Locked On Celtics on Instagram. One more person involved in this, and is a very important person and one of the more underrated people in Boston Celtics history. Later in that draft, the Boston Celtics, with the 13th overall pick, which at that point is the second round, they get Casey Jones, who was actually Bill Russell's teammate at San Francisco. And my contention, you tell me, I keep saying this, I'd like to hear your opinion on this. I keep saying that Casey Jones is Marcus Smart before Marcus Smart. What do you think?
Well, there's certainly, you can make a case for that. Casey was a top defensive player. He's in the Hall of Fame as well, and he never made an All-Star game. That might be a little bit because he was on so many championship teams, but he did have a lot to do with winning those championships. And Casey was not a scorer at all. He couldn't shoot jump shots, but he was man on ball type defender, was top notch for that day, especially. So yeah, there are some parallels between him and Smart, no doubt about it.
And part of that Hall of Fame resume, by the way, him and Bill Russell, NCAA champions, 1995 and 1996. So,
and Olympic gold.
And Olympic gold. So Casey Jones is kind of, I don't want to say forgotten, but if he wasn't the coach in the 80s, that I think most people nowadays, when you hear Casey Jones, that's what you think of, the coach who coached the big three to a couple of their championships. But that draft, that 1956 draft, gets Boston three cornerstone players, because they've got a scorer at the forward position in Tommy, they've got a lockdown defender in Casey Jones, and they've got a lockdown defender at the center spot in Bill Russell. And we all know Bill Russell. I mean, what can you say about Bill Russell? But he's a guy that not only was a great basketball player, one of the greatest athletes of his time, was prepared in that Olympics, if they didn't allow him to participate because of race, he was ready to participate in those Olympics as a track and field participant, because he's a world-class high jumper.
Bill Russell was an athlete and a thinker. I don't want to get into the whole comparison of generations type thing, but I think we do have to mention, I see a lot, and especially just for some reason the last couple of days, you know, people who say, oh, Bill Russell couldn't play today. That's hogwash.
Oh yeah. Nice, he hogwash, can play, by the way.
He could play. I'm channeling Brad. I mean, Russell was could play in any era. He was a spectacular athlete. And on top of that, he had the brains. That was, to me, his advantage over Wilt Chamberlain. He had the basketball IQ that Wilt lacked. And Russell could adapt his circumstances. He was just, I don't know, he was just a special person who revolutionized the game, and he could outthink the opposition. And he could play any type of game that he needed to play. Maybe if he played today, he wouldn't be a three-point shooter, but he would certainly be a superstar player no matter when he was playing.
Absolutely. I had a brief Twitter kind of exchange about this because somebody was trying to say that Draymond Green was the most valuable defensive player of all time. And I was like, I mean, in the back and forth, he was like, yeah, obviously Bill Russell's a better defender, but trying to make the case that Draymond was just so versatile. And I agree with you. It's hard to compare eras, but when you look at the level of athleticism Bill Russell had, the level of intelligence that Bill Russell had at 6'9", and being able to jump the way he did and defend Wilt Chamberlain, he would have been maybe the, even in this era, he would have been the runaway defensive player of the year multiple times. He would have been at 6'9", with his intelligence and athleticism, switching on everything, getting into people's airspace, getting them to do what he wants to do. I'm going to read this quote from the Minneapolis Lakers coach, John Kundla, back in Russell's era. And he says, quote, "We don't fear the Celtics without Bill Russell. Take him out and we can beat them. He's the guy who whipped us psychologically. Russell has our club worrying every second. Every one of the five men is thinking Russell is covering him on every play. He blocks a shot, and before you know it, Boston is getting a basket, and a play by Russell has done it." That's the level of impact that Bill Russell had. And there's nobody anywhere that had that kind of impact. No one has ever said that about Draymond Green. No one has ever said that about anybody. Bill Russell, that level of ability is what made him so special.
That quote is, it summarizes everything.
Yeah.
Because that was what Russell tried to do. He famously said, you don't have to block every shot. You just have to make them think that they're going to be blocked. And he had shared that sometimes he would let someone score off him, or let them get the shot off at least, because he would block them when they didn't expect it, and then they would be thinking too much.
So
let me also say, can I just talk about Bill Russell for a minute longer?
Absolutely.
Okay. He's my favorite player.
Good choice.
Favorite of all time. I won't say he's the greatest of all time, because there's a good argument for Michael Jordan, and I don't want to deal with his fans. But you know,
I'm going to tweet this out so people can get on.
Russell is the greatest winner. That's clear. Greatest winner of all time. He won everything at every level. He was 10-0 in game sevens. I think he was 21-0 in games where it was win or go home at all different levels. I mean, you don't get that by accident. And when Will Chamberlain came in the league, people were genuinely worried that he was just going to dominate. Nobody else would ever win again, just Wilt. And Russell was the person that kept that from happening. They both had great teammates. There's a lot of talk. A common belief is that Russell had better teammates. Well, Wilt played with just as many Hall of Famers as Russell did. Mm-hmm. The one thing that Russell had that Wilt didn't have was consistency, because Russell was with the Celtics and with Red Auerbach for his whole career. Wilt moved around, had a lot of different coaches. But part of that, most of that was his own doing, because Wilt was, you know, somewhat of a diva, and he could create turmoil. And so a lot of coaching changes, a lot of trades. He didn't make himself have a consistent career. And he had a fatal flaw, and that was his free throw shooting. How many times did his team lose a playoff game by 1 or 2 points and he missed 8 or 10 free throws? So, and one more example I'll give about Russell and Wilt. The year that Wilt averaged 50 points a game, which is inconceivable, but he did it. That series came down to that playoff. The Celtics played Philadelphia, Wilt's team, and it came down to the seventh game, and the Celtics won by, I think it was 1 or 2 points. Wilt, who had averaged 50 for the season, scored 22 in that game. Now, Bill Russell had something to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so Wilt might have been individually the better athlete or the better player than Bill Russell, but Bill Russell knew how to win.
That's what makes Bill Russell the best. But it wasn't always kind of rosy. And his arrival in Boston wasn't just like a, hey, you know, you're in Boston, here we go. Everybody hug each other and off we go. There's a lot more to that. So Bill Russell comes to Boston and basically says that he was preparing for an adversarial relationship with his coach because he'd had an adversarial relationship with coaches at every other level. And so he walks into Boston and is expecting just whatever. It didn't matter. He was just going to make it whatever. And then right away, and this is another important thing with Red Auerbach. Red Auerbach had already gone through his thing with Bob Cousy, and he challenged Bob Cousy. He didn't challenge Bill Russell. He made sure that Bill Russell knew that he was going to be accepted exactly for the type of player that he was. And Russell wrote in a biography that Red told me right out that he didn't care if I never scored a point. He said they had the guys on the Celtics who could score. What he wanted for me was defense and rebounding, and that suited me fine. And Red and Russell kind of developed this relationship where it's mutual respect. And I don't know that Bill Russell had ever gotten that level of respect from somebody. That was important to him. And it speaks to the understanding of what makes Red Auerbach such a great coach is understanding the players. Like all the best coaches say, okay, this guy needs to be challenged. This guy needs a little, maybe a hug sometimes. This guy needs to be respected, blah, blah, blah. And Red and Bill kind of come to this agreement that this is your job. You do your job well. I'm not going to make you who you're not. I'm going to just rely on you to be the best. The Brad Stevensism, right? Be the best version of yourself.
Yeah.
And that really is part of what propelled Russell. Now, let me be clear before I turn this over to you. Russell was probably going to do that anyway, because that's how Russell was. Like, I don't think that Red unlocked anything with Bill Russell. What Red did was make Bill Russell feel like he was part of the team, part of a family. And I think that was the most important aspect of their relationship.
Yeah, you know, Bill Russell wrote a book, Red and Me, subtitled My Coach, My Lifelong Friend. That was, 3-4 years ago. And he detailed all of that in that book. His relationship with Auerbach went beyond just player and coach. They were, in the end, lifelong friends. And I think the most important thing that comes through to me every time I read anything written by Russell, and he's done a few books, the most important thing to him is respect.
Mm-hmm.
He demands to be treated with respect. He knows that he deserves it, as any person does. They should not be disrespected for who they are. And he believes in that as a way of life. And Red respected him from day one, what you were talking about, that description of that whole way that played out. That's all about respect. And Red gave it to him immediately, and I'm sure that had a good influence on Russell.
Yeah, I mean, you got to have to look at Bill Russell's history at that time in his life. It's a very difficult time to be a young African-American man constantly dealing with the racism and all. Like that is something that strongly shapes who Bill Russell is. And when we talk about the 60s in the next week's series, we can get much more into a lot of the things that he faced on the road, because that there are a lot of things. He was instrumental in in the civil rights movement. He was a big part of the creation of the Players Union, which is a great story for the 60s. But in the beginning parts of his basketball career, I mean, you're talking about a young man who was born in Louisiana, who has seen the worst of the worst, yet is overcoming a lot of that because of his athletic abilities. But and this is to bring it to like a more current player. It's almost like the Jaylen Brown kind of mindset of like, look, I'm a basketball player, but that's not who I am. And part of Bill Russell is demanding this level of respect for himself as a human being first, and then we can get into the basketball player stuff. Red is just so critical in getting the most out of these guys and his understanding of who people are. And what they need to hear, what they want to hear is so important. And that's what makes a great coach a great coach. And his connection with Bill Russell is just magical. And a quote that I never used in that thing, but I have seen and have used. Basically, Bill Russell says, I never had to prove to him that I was a great player. And he never had to prove to me that he was a great coach. And throughout Bill Russell's young career, he feels like he has met people who feel the need to prove themselves. What Red does is understand that Bill Russell is great and respects him for his greatness and respects him for what he does very well. And that mutual respect, which is very difficult at that time of year for an African-American, which is such a critical element to this part of the story. You have to remember, this is 1956. These are the 1950s and 60s, where race is a major, major issue in the United States. It still continues to be, but obviously at that point, we're talking about the civil rights era. So Red's connection on a human level, man to man, the respect is what really gets this thing going and keeps Russell here in Boston and really going through some of like really horrible times off the court. That's going to be part of the 1960s discussion. Tomorrow, we continue the Bill Russell conversation and we get into Tommy Heinsohn. Tommy Heinsohn on the offensive end is huge for the Boston Celtics. Huge. We know Tommy for being the guy we love there, you know, on the broadcast. We know Tommy. Some of you may know him even as a coach. But Tommy Heinsohn, the player, in his short career, 9 years, was really pivotal on the offensive end for the Boston Celtics. And he makes a huge impact in his rookie year in a Game 7, one of the best Game 7s you're ever going to see. The stat line is amazing. That's going to be all tomorrow. So subscribe. If you're a subscriber, thank you very much. Follow the show on Spotify as well. A lot of you have Spotify. If you use Spotify for podcasts or your music, you can use it for podcasts too. Follow Locked On Celtics on Spotify as well. You can always give a 5-star rating and a good written review. Hopefully this show has earned your five-star rating. I'm going to keep trying to earn that five-star rating, so please do that as well. Thanks for listening, everybody. More on the Celtics history tomorrow. Now, go ahead and tell your smart device to play the latest episode of Chad Ford's Big Board.